businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to the brand new episode 209 of the Killing It Podcast. You guys are actually in sync. Like, I'm not gonna have to do anything to that.
This is instinctual at this point. We do it so well.
Smooth professionals.
Probably did it in your sleep last night, so.
Yes.
So guys, I'm gonna just dive right in because I'm excited to talk to you about our topics, and I want to warm us up a little bit. We're coming off the Olympics. If you could actually compete at an Olympic level, what athletic event would it be?
So I'm super non-athletic. Like, I've never actually been able to run, like, a block. But I think if I were in the Olympics, I would want to do archery. Just because it would be fun to actually be good at something like that. And I can shoot an arrow. I can't hit anything, right? And, you know, they always say if you miss the target, it's not the target's fault, right? But that kind of defines my business.
See, and if one of the options is not becoming a professional Olympic level Olympic watcher, which, by the way, I kind of did in the last couple of weeks, it was very compelling stuff. And by the way, super kudos to Paris for the way that they did the locations and the venues and everything. Like, seriously, that was cooler than any other Olympics. But I would still go back to where I am from, which is the soccer stuff. I was actually, as a teen coming up in a development program, Olympic track for the U23 men's soccer tournament. Now, I missed it because I wasn't good enough. But if I could overcome that in my youth, one only can imagine what the trajectory would have been. So the men's soccer team, they need some help. Let's just admit it. They need some help right now. They need to take some lessons from the women's side.
You might actually be the closest to being able to compete at that level than many of the other sports. And I'm with you, Ryan. Gold Zone was the greatest invention ever for peak. I got it. Like, the ability to watch all the sport all day long, and as they moved quickly around, and here's this one, and here's this one, and now here's gold over here, and here's gold over here. I was addicted, and it was too fun. But if you were actually...
And, oh, by the way, it's in front of the Eiffel Tower. Come on.
It was pretty cool. If I'm picking a sport, I'm going to go with distance cycling because that feels the most useful. Because not only could I actually, like, do it at that level, I could then also commute locally in really useful ways. Like, it feels like it would be a really cool sport.
Right. You could get back to pedaling your electric bike.
I know. Exactly. I want to take time off e-bike.
And I'm pretty sure Carl's skill is also tactically applicable. So in a world, I'm thinking being able to play soccer, that's cute. But archery would get you some kudos.
On occasion, you really need that skill.
All righty. Well, let's dive into it. We have three topics as usual. So the first topic we're going to dig into today is MIT. We're going to put a link in the show notes, but MIT has released an AI risk repository, which is literally 700 articles and published papers on risks that you need to be aware of with artificial intelligence. And the cool thing about this is if you go to the link that we give you, it's at MIT, at the university, and they allow you to download this as an Excel spreadsheet. So if you want to do your own analysis, sort, filter, whatever, do counts on keywords, anything you want to do, this, what I love about this is it's an academic view of something that is kind of what we in the nerd world would call open source, right? So, you know, here you have this open source database and you can decide for yourself whether or not it's useful. Now, who is it useful to? Well, it's 10% of this audience and 0% of your clients.
Oh, I disagree completely. Okay, this is good when we disagree. So we're like in the golden age of NIST and academic frameworks for that I feel are incredibly useful in business. Again, I'm going to fall back on my, like, basic concept of the true value of IT services organizations is in their expertise in guiding customers to the correct technologies. And you have more than any time ever academics and industry professionals who spend their entire lives thinking about this in a conceptual sense and give you all of the resources to be incredibly smart very quickly on a lot of topics. And I look at a database like this and say, this is exactly the kind of useful framework that I can then take to customers and apply when I need to consider and answer their questions. I don't have to talk in theoretical terms about what AI risk is. I have exact models and use cases to compare against to understand where the smartest people around who just spent their time thinking about this have given me all of the resources needed. And you can get up to speed on practices at an incredibly rapid rate and leverage incredible intelligence quickly with your customers. And I say, so what I want people to think is I'm not saying I think everyone needs to go like and learn all 700 and, you know, some scenarios. It's more the, you need to be a really good person at matching information to your customers, and you're given a searchable, indexable, sortable resource that you can use very quickly. And so I look at this and say, you know, your job is knowing all these resources. These resources are available to you, and leveraging them makes you exceptional. And so to your point, Carl, like, is, oh, only 10% will use it? Yeah, those are the best 10%.
Well, and those are the 10% who are going to get paid for their professional services and consulting advice, right? So I have three comments about this that I think it is very interesting. Number one, thank you very much, MIT, for quantifying what has up until now been just a general sense of foreboding doom. Right. Everybody has said AI equals risk. What kind of risk? Well, one and two and three. And holy cow, you can't imagine how many. Yes, we can, because we're scientists and because in a professional world, you can say there are not just a lot, there are a number. And that's very good. Right. Number two. And by the way, there are at least 700 risks with AI. We all know that intuitively, but we need a number to work against. Number two. Exactly to your point, Carl, very few customers are going to go into that and try to solve for these problems, because it is the paralysis by analysis paradox, right? It's literally, I can be responsible. Holy cow, there's too many things to be responsible about. I'm just going to do what I was going to do anyway, and we're just going to hope that everything works out okay. Customers are not going to go in there and use this information. But point number three, I think, and if anybody would like to know how to do this, we would be happy to do this for you. You can package a service offering by industry, by customer size, that says an AI risk assessment for your organization. I will examine the following X number of categories and specific use cases. I will identify actual behavior within your organization, a profile of what your business processes are, what is actually going on in the real world too, because I have network tools that allow me to identify whether these tools are being used in your environment. And I can give you an action-oriented report that says, here are your vulnerabilities, here are the action item recommendations, and here's exactly what you should do about that stuff. Oh, and by the way, if it's in the SMB world, that costs $5,000 to $10,000 for that level of work, and it's going to be highly templatized. If I'm in the mid-market, I'm talking 25 to 35, and it's going to require some interviews. If you happen to want to get involved with some divisions of larger enterprises in your local neighborhood, this is a great way to get your foot in the door and get a 50 to 100K services gig that is A, very timely, and B, once you've done it a few times and you've figured out what the templates are, it is oh so infinitely repeatable that your margin shouldn't be 50% on that thing. They should be 75% on that thing. So well, this is great.
That to me makes the point that 10% of our audience is actually interested in going to all that work or to do that kind of a deep dive. I do think this is a rich, rich area to create a spectacular presentation on the dangers of AI that you can give in 20 minutes, not a super crazy deep dive, but just literally browse through this thing and say, well, What are the concerns about privacy? What are the concerns about misinformation? What are the concerns about bad actors? Right? Da 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 da. And, you know, get a few things where you can point to the references that are outlined, because this is all referencing articles, referencing articles, referencing articles. So you could repeat that to the Kiwanis, the Rotary, the BNI, the Morning Chambers of Commerce. You can give this presentation every day for the next month, and you might get some clients out of it. Most people
we can say that about everything, right? We can say that about everything. Most people will not execute. And that's why, like, you know, in a certain degree, like, I don't mind talking about it, because it's the, look, I know a lot of people aren't going to do it. You don't want to be that person, right? You want to be the person that actually executes. And that's where the value is.
Well, and to your point, Carl, if you're not going to package it the way I described and sell it as a professional service, please use it as a promotional vehicle to get into a conversation that then says, oh, and by the way, we could monitor your network for you. You should sign a managed services contract, right? Like, that, to me, is a very topical reality that almost everybody can use. But we're done giving you advice on that topic. Let's move on to our next one, guys. And in the ripped from the headlines of the most obvious news that any of us have encountered recently, Google has a monopoly. What? Say it isn't so. And not just a monopoly, but a monopoly in search. So the news, if you have not been keeping up with this, this is not immediate. This is not just a short-term assessment where somebody woke up one day and decided to point fingers. This is years of analysis and legal exploration going into a scenario to examine the business behavior, not the prevalence of technology, but the business practices around the application, requiring it to be positioned as default, requiring compatibilities and embedded capabilities with their search engine in other people's software. It's not the technology, it is the business behavior around the technology that apparently has risen to a level. Now, we've been talking about some things that we believe are obvious monopolies in many dimensions of our industries for a number of years. This is the first time anybody with any authority actually said something about it since Microsoft. That's a million years ago. What do you guys think is actually going to come from this? And do you believe this is going to change anything about their behavior?
I want to make predictions. I'm totally on board for this. So I'm going to say I don't think Google will get broken up. I think that is one of those moves that the government doesn't generally like to do if they don't have to, and I'm not sure it's necessarily as clean. I could see a very clear argument for you could split sort of Google, you know, main Google search with YouTube. Makes sense to me, because you end up with a world of two search engines, but I don't actually, because their first immediate move would to make themselves, like, search the other thing, right? It makes a lot of sense if you want to create a search engine bit, but I actually think they're going to be a little bit more cautious. I think the main thing I'm going to see out of this is a ban on these contracts where they're buying off someone else to not get in there. The obvious one is Apple, right? Google just writes a check to Apple so that they don't wants this for placement as a search engine, but it also disincentivizes Apple from ever looking at that. And I think they're going to clearly say, like, when you are at some measurable level of the dominant player, you cannot buy your way to hold on that. You've got to compete. I think that's going to be the obvious remedy that we'll see out of this. Whether or not that will inspire players like Apple to get into search will be an interesting play. I think... The one thing that I'm looking for is a remedy that actually does create the opportunity to create new markets. And I'll be interested in, and by the way, just slowing Google down might do that. I think it's arguable that their search results have been garbage for a while now, and that they are not delivering on the best product. And if they're distracted by having to handle a bunch of legal stuff, it might open the opportunity up for somebody else to do something there. But I think the obvious bit is we're going to say, nope, can't buy your way to the top of the market.
So a couple of things. First of all, thank goodness the EU has done a better job of being effective with managing the big tech giants than the United States. And I think that basically saying, no, you can't do that, has already set Google on the path to figuring out how they're going to handle this. I don't know what their answer is, but I know that Google knows what their answer is. I do think it's interesting. So it's not illegal to have a monopoly. It is illegal to behave like a monopoly. So it's like, okay, here's a question. If you could choose any search engine in the world, which you can, would you choose Google? Today and day after day after day, I do. Not that it is the greatest I could possibly imagine. You know, it's sort of like the government, right? It's not the best democracy that can be made. It's the best that we will accept, right? So I would like Google to be better in many ways. And I think the interesting part is the look at Microsoft is probably a good example that what they really did is they looked at little things like, well, you can't make a deal with IBM so that IBM has to pay you for an operating system, whether they install it or not. Like, holy crap, right? Like, that's a genius move if you're selling. It's not a great move if you're buying. And maybe they will figure out how to open it up and have some real competition. Apple would be smart to never get into the search business. So they're always going to buy a partner. And it's just a matter of, okay, can somebody else offer them more money than Google or a better deal or something that fits better with their future AI offering or fits better with their ecosystem, right? What's the searching that works best for them separate from everybody else? And I would love to think that there's a future where we each have these bespoke search engines. I have what works for my business. You have what works for your business, right? There are lots of specialty search engines, but they're really hard to use unless you're in that specialty. And so maybe we're going to force some innovation to other people as well.
Before I let Ryan go, I'm going to just make a quick comment. You asked a really good question, like, would you choose something else? I'm finding that for at least 50% of my searches, I'm not choosing Google. I'm, in fact, choosing ChatGPT. And the reason, you know, is I have a focused question. I generally know that it will be in the vast, broad, settled amount of knowledge. Like, it's not something that this is just, you know, that is going to be variable or timely. And by the way, the fact that it gives me a couple of sources means I can double check its work. And it's the, like, you know, it's an established thing that hasn't been known for 20 years. That's a great way of getting it. I'm 50% of my searches, I'm not choosing.
Well, see, and this is where, if you go back to the fundamentals of why is monopoly behavior frowned upon, right? Why do we actually care about that? Well, it's because you use market position and money to substitute competition and innovation, right? If you have the very best product and you achieve a dominant market position because it is bigger, better, faster than anything else that's out there, congratulations to you and congratulations to me as the user, because you've made my life better with a product that is demonstrably better than anything else. When you get to that position, and to your point, Carl, you begin to behave in a monopolistic way, what happens is you buy your market dominance instead of earn your market dominance, meaning you take your foot off the gas pedal of innovation and you cease to ship the best technology, which punishes not only the buyers, but also the actual customers, the users. That's exactly where Dave's example is going. The capabilities of AI, of Gen AI added to search, makes the potential for that for that service, for that basic technology, dramatically better than anything we have been accustomed to in the last 20 years. Google has not done well with that. They have stumbled into a lot of the research that I'm reading in my own personal experience. There are many times I will ask a question in Google and everything I get back is an ad. Literally everything I get back is an ad. Not cool. That's not what I'm looking for. ChatGPT has some reliability and hallucination problems, but it does give me a more robust answer. But Google still is the A number one by a long way in the marketplace because they forced it through monopolistic behavior rather than earned it through innovation. If this has that simple impact on the search market, it solves a problem I'm all for it. If it sends a warning sign to others in other marketplaces to stop it with the buying dominance and go back to a world where you actually innovate and earn, that would be a pipe dream. I don't think we're going to get there yet. It'll take some more raps on the knuckle before anybody else actually changes behavior, but this is a good start.
I would say, just for a note, Google has made a pretty good case. They do continue to innovate. And my number two search engine is YouTube.
So maybe they will get programmed. But I'm going to move us on to the last topic. And I want to take an interesting angle on this. So NIST just released their guidance for cryptography for quantum computing. And I will sort of say, like, look, it's an interesting set of framework for those that are in the encryption space, get to work, guys, because you've got new data. But what I wanted to do is I actually sort of rejected this story for the business of tech, and I wanted to bring it to you guys instead, because I looked at this and said, okay, there's the obvious element of upgrade your cryptography when there's a new, better version. That's just always makes sense. But I feel like quantum computing as a thing has always been, well, we're like within 10 years of it, every 3 years, as far as I can remember. Now, at this point, I mean, it just feels like we're so close to quantum that I've come to the point where I think I just don't believe them. I think I just don't think this is a thing. And I will open a space for sure in the 27th century, when the next version of Star Trek is out, we may have quantum computing. But I don't think in any practical terms, this is a thing. Am I missing the boat? Like, I want to gut check here. What's your take on quantum?
Like, so much technology, and you know, we've seen this just recently in the pandemic, where we're saying, oh, how come robots aren't taking over the world? Well, because in the real world, people are saying, well, I'll work for a dollar less if you don't take my job away. And so it's delayed the actual use of that technology. I think things like, you know, the fact that we have GPUs and we have these processors that can just, you know, put more horsepower on a problem, we don't have a need for quantum computing. It's not that it's not real or it's not there or it's not going to happen. If it doesn't happen, it'll be because we don't need it, because we can continually increase horsepower. And even though we don't increase the horsepower necessarily with one chip, having more and more processors, but we can now buy NVIDIA chips by the gallon, right? And so we'll just buy more horsepower, and then they get smaller and smaller and smaller. So,
see, and I will go to the next order of impact, right? Because what Carl's saying is, if I have an alternative technology that I can use to solve the future problem, it's existing, it's tested, it's understood, let's just do what's familiar. I'll go to the next level and say that I think the thing that will prevent rapid deployment of quantum is the environmental impact. And I don't mean just on trees and waterways and cute little bunnies in nature. What I mean is the literal environment in which these systems play. The power consumption requirements for quantum computing are projected, because nobody really has one of these things yet, right? If you're going to use one of these that does what it is scientifically suggested it could do, it's going to consume power at a rate beyond even what these data centers are doing for AI, which we know is an order of magnitude beyond what regular data centers did. And we already covered years ago, if you guys remembered, a story about the health impacts for people living in proximity of large format data centers. The hum that happens 24/7 leads to hearing problems, it creates sleeping problems, etc., right? Order of magnitude to AI, further order of magnitude up to the consumption of what quantum computing is going to be. I don't think we can't innovate out of that. I think that the world will look around and go, I'm not willing to pay you the extra second order costs in order to consume this technology. I will buy a quantum computer for X, but then in order to heat it, in order to cool it, to power it, in order for it to live in a place where it doesn't poison the local citizenry, it's going to cost me X times four. I'm not willing to pay the X times four, so thank you very much. I'll just stick with what I'm doing right now. I think the capability, the potential, the stories we've been told about quantum, yes, they are fascinating, but they are not yet economically viable. And that's an engineering problem. That's not a scientific problem. That's an engineering problem. You need to figure out a way to deploy power without consumption. That's a single variable that you need to control for in designing and deploying these kinds of systems. By the way, one last comment. If quantum does happen, all y'all cybersecurity is grandma stuff, right? It is outdated. It is the olden times, and it does not work in a quantum world. We do not presently possess cryptography that can withstand quantum attacks for longer than just a couple of minutes, right? We're literally not using technology. So if and when quantum comes, I hope y'all are thinking about the cyber impacts, because it's going to break all your tools.
Hold on. I want to break that sentence down. First off, when is the question? And I'm coming to the conclusion of it isn't. And if is doing a whole lot of heavy lifting right there, Ryan, because yes, if when is never, if doesn't matter. Right?
That's right. Sentence diagramming by
right. Dave. I'm just getting back to the basics here and sort of observing that, okay, sure, I hear you on all of this stuff, but I'm coming to the conclusion that this isn't a thing. And in fact, like head cycles spent on it in any level is just sort of not worth my time. Now, I will give a space of, look, I think making things generally more secure, and I'm putting that in big old air quotes, right, is a good thing, right? My statement is okay, if you've designed a new set of encryption that is invulnerable to this theoretical thing that is way more advanced than our regular stuff, well, then it should also be good enough for our regular stuff. And I don't see any reason to not do it. But if somebody says, Dave, I want you to spend time and brain cycles on this thing that only benefits quantum computing, I think my answer is, that's a waste of my time, and I'm not doing any work on it because you don't even prove you can make the thing. Like, literally, the basics of making it have not even been proven.
So to Ryan, I would say, literally, all of your objections, old man, can be overcome and will be overcome by time and technology, right? Everything starts out being too expensive. Everything's impossible. Everything costs too much, right? If you think of how many, you know, BTUs did it take to light a house 100 years ago? Well, you know, you got to get the kerosene, but you have to get the kerosene to the house and da-da-da-da-da, like, holy smokes. Now you have LED lights that take essentially nothing except static electricity, right? So the future will take care of itself. To Dave, I would say, I have been hearing about AI since before I was born. Like, literally, you watch old black and white science fiction movies and TV shows. They've been talking about AI for 60 years. And then one day, it became reality. And everybody, like, 5 years ago, you could have made the argument, they've been talking about AI for 50 years, and it's never going to happen, right? I think it's going to be the exact same thing with quantum computing. Part of it is, with AI, we haven't figured out the killer app. We haven't figured out a thing that's sort of the email equivalent of the web, right? That what is it that we would do with quantum computing? What's the killer app of quantum computing? Well, if you're not a quantum physicist or you're not a mathematician, I'm not sure there's a use for it outside of your paycheck.
Well, and that's the thing, right? There are use cases. They're just not economically viable yet, right? I agree with you, Carl. The ecosystem of technology will solve for the problems that I've been outlining. That sounds like opportunity, and it sounds like business development to me, right? From an industry perspective, my thing is, I do believe that the future takes forever until it happens all at once. Exactly as Carl's describing, it will come. To Dave's point, not this year. And if you're focused on this year, please don't spend any time building a quantum practice. But it will come. We just need to be ready for it.
Well, I want to push back slightly there, Carl, because while you're right on the AI stuff, we have seen advancements along the way for a good portion of that, right? Like, we could go back in time, let's say 2015. I worked on projects that were advanced, like that were data science stuff, that was using machine learning, that was a stretch to be AI, that had the glimmers of that. And you could go back further than that, and you could see versions where we're building, you know, the systems that communicate that. And so, like, I have this element of, I saw a trend line over time of advancements, and you're right. All of a sudden, we see the breakthrough, and it crashes through. What I'm pushing back on is they don't even have the basic bits over on quantum. It's all whiteboard stuff where nothing actually works, right? And so there's a difference between seeing elements of it and you guys are having fun on a whiteboard and that's all cool, but until you can actually build any of it, stop wasting my time.
Maybe AI will be the tool that productizes quantum.
Perhaps.
That replaces itself with quantum.
Perhaps.
Well, when the word theoretical is sort of built into your definition, maybe you'll never show up in the real world.
Maybe you'll never show up.
And with that happy note, we bring an end to episode 209 of the Killing It
Good
podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.